Stay tuned. Nature News is coming up next, right here on WTZQ.
Join us now for an informative look at the world of nature with local naturalist and educators Carlton Burke and Dan Lazar, reporting on all the natural events occurring right here in wild western North Carolina. From bugs to bears and everything in between, get ready to explore the rich natural heritage of our southern Appalachian Mountains.
Hello and welcome to another broadcast of Nature News, a program that is informative in the way of telling you and informing you and keeping you in touch with what is happening in the wilds of western North Carolina and the surrounding southern Appalachian Mountain region. That's what Nature News does. We follow the things that are happening in the world of nature on a seasonal basis and report on those things in our local reporting area here in the southeastern United States. And as usual, I'm here. I'm one of your normal, regular, educational presenters here, a naturalist. My name is Carlton Burke, but I'm not alone. I'm joined by...
My name is Dan Lazar. I'm also a normal, regular guy, just like Carlton.
Well, yeah, I stated that I was normal for a person, a purpose. I didn't expect for you to say you were normal, too.
Well, I would say I'm at least as normal as you are.
Okay, well, I'll give you that. We're both normal in that we are naturalists, and naturalists may be not the most normal of all people, but... We have different bents, different ideas about things, but I think they're good ideas.
Oh yeah.
You know, we think good things about almost everything in nature, except maybe ticks and fleas and mosquitoes.
Well, even they have their role in
that's
in
true.
Nature's
they do serve as food for
economy.
some other animals. You know, but in any case, just have a little fun there. We are somewhat normal, but that is what we focus on, the world of nature. We've been doing that here at Nature News for well over 30 years now. So we invite you to be a part of our program if you haven't already in that time period. And we'll tell you how to get in touch with us a little bit later, because we're always looking for people's reports, people's comments, people's topics they'd like us to discuss. If you have a question about the world of nature in our local area here in the southern Appalachian Mountain region here in the United States, we love to hear from you. And I say the United States because sometimes we have people that are listening from somewhere far away. You can actually access Nature News from almost anywhere in the world if you have internet access. So we'll tell you how to do that as well coming up a little bit later in our program. So once again, thanks for joining us here today at Nature News. This is our broadcast for the weekend of May the 23rd, 2026. And you know, people always say, I just can't believe it's already May 23rd or June 1st or Memorial Day weekend or something like that. But I'm telling you what, the April is a kind of a slow month. And April and May are my two favorite months of the entire year. And April actually went slow, and I like that. But May has seemed to just go at rocket speed, and I can't believe it's almost over. I think in the world of nature, things speed up out there with the plants blooming and animals starting to have their babies and all that kind of stuff, and it just kind of filters over, and everything just seems like it's in high gear, and spring just springs forward and goes fast. And then when you get in those really hot days of summer, it kind of slows down a little bit, at least the way we perceive it. But May is a glorious month. It's been a great month. And just so many things out there in the world of nature to enjoy. I wish we can make May last for months instead of just 1 month.
Well, yeah, that would be nice.
That would be nice.
Enjoy it while it's here. I've been spending a lot of time in the evenings and in the morning, right around dawn, sitting outside.
You get up early at dawn?
Yeah.
Ooh, that's really good.
When I hear the birds, you know, I get up, and it does lengthen the day if you just kind of, you probably don't have time to do this.
Maybe that's what I should do. Maybe I'm sleeping too late, and if I got up earlier, the day would be longer, and it seems like May would be longer.
Well, then you'd have to go to bed earlier, too.
Well.
That could be a problem. But you know, then, you know, and just sitting on the deck, watching the clouds drift by, if there are clouds, or else watching the sun, the sky gradually changing, the curtain of night lifting, seeing the landscape open up, hearing the birds as they start to come out. All this is before, you know, actually getting up and eating breakfast. That makes the days seem a little longer.
Yeah.
And then if you can do the same thing at night, really appreciate the landscape of the southern Appalachian.
You know, we should have a spinoff nature news program. You like some TV program have a spinoff program. Right. We should have a spinoff nature news program called Early Mornings on the Deck with Dan or something like that. And you could talk about all these things that happen in early morning on your deck because you're spending a lot more time on deck time these days than usual. I mean, you're usually out hiking and doing stuff, but you're spending a whole lot more time on your deck than you used to.
Yeah, one of the benefits of being retired is you can do that. So you sit out on your deck and just enjoy the day. But almost magical to see the beauty of the Southern Appalachians during April and May as the green color starts working its way upslope. And also now that most of the trees in my forest have blown down thanks to the hurricane, I have a good view of the sky, too, so I've been watching a lot of solar events and also stellar events and planetary events in the night sky. Anyway, just get up before dawn and spend the first hour and a half just sitting outside somewhere. That will make the day seem a little bit longer.
And speaking of the sky and that kind of stuff from your deck and all, and you mentioned seeing all that kind of stuff, that might be a good feature to start with today is what we call our eye to the sky report.
Yeah, okay.
And that's where we look overhead to the nighttime sky and we think about things like meteor showers, report on things like eclipses and constellation, planet viewing, all that kind of stuff. So Dan, do you have an eye to the sky report for
us here today
at Nature News?
Yeah, this is an evening eye to the sky. I've been enjoying this for the past several weeks and it's just going to get better and better. And that is if you look toward the sunset, which is also a beautiful event in the night sky. After the sun goes down, the first other light you'll see in the sky other than the moon, if the moon is out, is the planet Venus, which is our brightest object in the sky other than the sun or the moon. And it will be in the direction of the sunset, part ways up the sky, not that high above the horizon, but it'll be the first star-like object you see. And then if you're watching that and the sunset is still fading and Venus is glowing brightly, the next object that appears in the night sky is the planet Jupiter, which is, other than Venus, the brightest star-like object in the night sky. Well, the thing to observe is that Venus is steadily moving closer and closer. I mean, Jupiter is steadily moving closer and closer to Venus. And so if you see Venus, Jupiter will be to the upper left-hand side of Venus. So if it was a clock face, Jupiter would be at about 10:30 to 11 o'clock in the night sky. But each day, it gets closer and closer to Venus.
In reality, is it really getting closer?
No.
Is it just because of our perception, because of positioning what that here on Earth as we look at it? It looks like it's getting closer.
Yeah. So, Venus is orbiting the Sun closer to the Sun than Earth is. Jupiter is orbiting the Sun, but much farther away than Earth is. But right now, if you can imagine looking at the solar system from some place on top of the solar system, watching the planets as they rotate, the Sun would be in the center, Earth, Venus and Jupiter would all be lined up on the same side of the Sun, with Venus not too far away from the Sun as we see it. And Jupiter, if you look out past Venus, like, I don't know, four times the distance from Earth to Venus, you would see Jupiter. So it's way in the distance, but it's bright enough because it's big that it looks bright. So Venus appears to be the brightest object other than the Moon in the sky because Venus is close to the Earth. And also, it's covered by a complete layer of clouds, so it reflects a lot of light, making it very bright. Jupiter is much farther away, doesn't reflect as much light, but because it's so much larger, it also looks bright. So picture looking down on the solar system, sun in the center, say picture the Earth at about, 7 p.m. on a clock face, looking down at the solar system. Venus and Jupiter would both be at about 10:30 or 11 on that clock face. So the sun is a little bit off to your right-hand side, and then we're looking beyond the sun to see both Venus and Jupiter. They're both beyond the sun at this point. And so from our perspective here on the Earth, we see these two planets, and they're both orbiting, and so as we see it, Jupiter is approaching closer and closer to Venus. So one good thing about doing that is it kind of makes you realize that, we're part of a solar system. We're moving. These other planets are moving. You can see the motion in their sky. You can't see their motion if you're staring at them one night, but you come back the next night and you can notice the difference. And so they're getting closer and closer together. And they will appear to be almost touching each other, which what we call is a planetary conjunction, Carlton.
A conjunction of planets. Is Dan, is that something we can talk about on air?
Yeah, yeah.
That's like an adult subject.
No. Just because Venus is named after the goddess of beauty and love, and Jupiter is named after a male god.
Oh, no.
A god in ancient times, and they're approaching closer and closer. They're not going to touch.
Okay, all right.
So around June 7th or 8th, they're going to be very close together. They'll be so close together that if you put your extend your arm out and put your little finger out, and it would be that apparent distance on the horizon. So only you could barely fit your little finger's image between Venus and Jupiter.
So you're saying a conjunction is basically when planetary bodies get very close or appear to us on Earth to be very, very close
right.
together, much
yes.
closer than normal.
Right, yeah.
Right, okay.
And so it's...
That can happen with more than two objects then, right?
Oh, it could, yeah. In fact, the Moon will be getting kind of close at the same time Jupiter and Venus are in conjunction. The Moon, crescent Moon, will be also in that same general area. And this will be right after the sunset, beautiful sunset, the colors of the sunset, and then the planets getting closer and closer together, and the crescent Moon out there at the same time. It'll be a beautiful time to stargaze. But you know, if you have a place where you can sit out and see the western sky in the evenings, this would be a nice time to do it. Just sit out there and watch as these planets get closer and closer and closer during the early evening, early night time, just after sunset.
You don't have to have a deck to do that?
You don't have to have a deck. You can, if you want to, you can drive to somewhere with a clear view to the west and just observe that. It's a great
But
night.
In case people don't have a deck, could we give out your address so they could come to your deck and view all this?
No, we can't do that. But structurally, the deck would not
support. Wouldn't you like to meet with some of our listeners, Dan?
But a lot of
share your deck experience with everybody in person?
Well, a lot of people are going to the Haw Creek Overlook along the Blue Ridge Parkway or any overlook that faces toward the west. I mean, you could do this, it wouldn't be as good. I was going to say you could do it like in a big parking lot, but they usually have lights on. That would kind of ruin it. Just an old field, somewhere a big, big empty old field without lights at the night, and you can view this spectacular event.
Right.
So that's one thing you could look for. And the other thing on Eye of the Sky, I'd like to mention, also involves a planet or a former planet.
I bet I know what that is.
Yeah.
Is it Pluto?
Pluto, yeah.
Pluto, Dan, back when me and you grew up, Pluto was the ninth planet of the solar system. It was fact.
Right.
No doubt about it. We were taught that for years.
Right.
Then suddenly, I don't know when it was, but they suddenly decided Pluto was not a planet, and they booted it out of the planet solar system map and saying it was just like a large body of ice that's floating around or something like that.
They were still calling it a minor planet.
A minor planet.
But it was not the same as a planet.
Well, it was the smallest planet, right?
It was, yeah.
Yeah. So,
and the farthest out planet.
So why did they decide it was not a planet to begin with?
Well, one of the criteria is that the planet had to clear its orbital path. In other words, nothing else is orbiting in the same path as the Earth. Over time, since the formation of the solar system, anything that was in the path of the Earth collided with the Earth, was absorbed by the Earth, and now there's nothing else orbiting in the same pathway as the Earth. And that's the same for Venus and Mars and Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus, Neptune, all the other planets, Mercury, they've cleared their orbital path. So that was decided. That was a definition of a planet.
Whereas, can't Pluto just be a little different? I mean, just because it beats to marches to the beat of a different drummer, does that mean it's not a planet? I was just so upset when they said it wasn't a planet.
Yeah, I remember that story on Nature News when they booted Pluto out. Well, the news about that, because,
It's like it was bad as when they got rid of Coke, original Coke, a long time ago. Remember
that? Too, yeah, they had the new Coke.
But, back in the 1990s or 80s or
sometime
something like
in
that.
Distance past. Mm. But so Pluto had other objects orbiting in the same orbital path. It had cleared its orbital path, so Pluto is out. Well, anyway, now there is a movement to readmit Pluto.
Oh yeah.
And based.
Where do I sign the petition?
I don't know. There probably is a petition. You probably look that up online. And not only Pluto, but
probably have to be a scientist to sign it.
Oh, I don't know.
I'd have to have a degree in astronomy or something.
Well, the one thing that was in the news recently was the head of NASA, a 10-year-old girl in Florida, wrote a letter to NASA because she liked Pluto, and she said she would like Pluto to be readmitted into the solar system as a planet, and sent this nice letter. And the head of NASA replied to her, and he said he agreed that he thinks Pluto should be a planet. And also, there are a number of other objects out there in the Kuiper Belt, large bodies, minor planets, which also could be, and they're the, you don't, you know, the solar system could grow to 15, 20, 25 yeah. planets if they do all this.
Yeah.
But then it would be hard to remember all the names.
Yeah.
So, anyway, so the news now is that they are reconsidering the eviction of Pluto from the solar system, and it possibly could be readmitted. I mean, they just took a vote at some astronomers' convention. They
that
just
doesn't
voted,
seem quite fair.
And booted it out. Hmm. And so at present we have 8 planets in the solar system, but there's a possibility we may have 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 at some point in the future. So that's stay just, tuned. You'll hear it here on Nature News.
Well, that's just a human thing. You know, a piece of paper that says something, that doesn't mean that Pluto is not a planet
right.
when it really comes down to it. But that is interesting. So maybe Pluto will be readmitted formally into the solar system
that's
as
right.
a planet.
That's right.
Interesting. So that's it for our Eye to Sky report today on Nature News.
Okay.
Well, we're going to pause for a moment, give you our contact information. Then, Dan, we're going to come back with a story about some other lights in the sky that you can see. And it's not during the daytime, just like planets. And these lights flash on and off. And they are seen in the evening hours, and we're coming in the season where you see them, but you don't see them year-round. I mean, you can see planets year-round in the nighttime sky, and they don't flash on and off.
No.
These are local lights that flash on and off. Be thinking about that. You probably know what we're getting ready to talk about, and we'll talk about that just right after the break here. So let's tell people how to get in touch with us here at Nature News
okay.
if they'd like to write in and send us your reports that you see of animal movements, plants in flower, anything you have a question about the world of nature, a comment about the program, a topic for discussion, anything having to do with the world of nature, we'd like to hear from you here. And we do have some list of reports coming up a little bit later here. And so most people get in touch by our email address. That's naturenewswnc@gmail.com. Again, that's naturenewswnc@gmail.com. But some people also pick up the phone and leave us a voicemail message, and you can do that 24 hours a day. And that telephone number is 828 area code if you're outside our area, and then 891-5169. Again, area code 828, and then phone number 891-5169. Or you can also send a letter or postcard the old-fashioned way, address your correspondence to Nature News, and address it to 3150 North Mills River Road, and that is Mills River, two words there, North Carolina. And the zip code 28759. And we really would love to hear from you, even if you don't really have anything to say other than to say, hey, we're listening to Nature News.
That'd
be good enough too.
Okay, so now we have mysterious lights in the evening sky flashing on and off.
Yeah, I think you know what they are.
Could it be stars that are descending closer to Earth?
No, not stars.
Pulsars, maybe?
And in fact, the things that we see are usually kind of, well, some of them are greenish in color or bluish or... But a lot of them are kind of yellowish in color. Depends on the species.
Uh-huh.
So if you're a species, you must be something living.
Right.
A planet is not living.
Could they be bioluminescent beetles?
Not in this particular case. Well, when you think about it, yes, technically they are bioluminescent beetles.
Okay.
Because they are fireflies.
Right.
And fireflies are beetles, believe it or not. A lot of people don't know that. But we're entering our firefly season here in western North Carolina. And I did see my first firefly, lightning bug in my driveway at my house earlier this week.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know exactly what species what it was, but I haven't been out in the woods to check, but I'd be willing to bet also if we were out in the woods right now, because this is a traditional time of year, they have probably been going for the last 10 days more than likely, the blue ghost fireflies should be out, which are very different firefly species. They're very, very small and glow for long periods of time instead of flashing on and off. So we are definitely into firefly season right here in western North Carolina right now.
We need to go out looking for blue ghosts. We haven't done that yet this year. So one of these days.
Yeah.
So blue ghosts.
This is the time of year to do it.
They come out, like, I don't know, around 9:30. They stay active for about an hour and a half.
Right, just a little bit after dark.
They fly really low, like 1 foot off the ground or maybe even less, like below your knees.
Mm-hmm.
And the males keep their lights, and they're tiny. They're like really small, or lightning bugs. About the size of maybe, what, grain of rice. And so they keep their lights on for half a minute, maybe 45 seconds continuously, and they're just flying in kind of a zigzag pattern over the ground. And the light from their abdomen actually makes a little circle of blue-greenish light on the ground as they're these little lanterns moving around that, silently.
Yeah, they actually have a little spotlight, so to speak, that they can shine down, and it's really eerie.
Yeah.
If you ever see it, say, whoa, what is that?
Yeah, it's very impressive, and they're not noticeable from a distance. And if you're out traveling on roadsides, you probably won't notice them. If your eyes
you've got to turn the lights out.
Yeah, if your eyes are not used to the dark, you probably won't see them. But if you get out into a field, and it's usually a deciduous forest, usually kind of moist, maybe down near a stream, a lot of leaf litter on the ground, that's where the females are. And you might just look around and wait a few minutes, and you may start noticing them. They're very faint. But if you do notice them, it's a magical experience. These silent little lights just floating everywhere, surrounding you. And it's obviously, the males are the ones that are up shining their lights, searching for females. The females are on the ground. They don't have wings. They're kind of what they call larva form or grub-like, like little white grubs. But if they notice the male light, they might produce a little bit of light of their own. They have a number of little light-producing organs, and this could attract the male for mating, and this would allow more lightning bugs to come back for the following years. So the blue ghosts have become pretty famous in our area.
Yeah, and if you're going to go look for them, you won't find them just everywhere. That's the thing. They're just found here and there in some rich woods, usually a lot of times near streams, like where there's rhododendron cover and that sort of thing. And they're only for a short period of time. So like Dan said, they're pretty famous in our area, and there are some organizations that offer actually trips to go see them. And you can sign up for one of those or go looking for them yourself. Places like Pisgah National Forest, DuPont State Recreational Forest are some of the hot spots here locally. But they are not the only firefly that can be seen this time of year. In fact, maybe some of the more traditional fireflies would be easier to find. The ones that have bigger lights, the ones that are bigger and flash on and off.
And are out in the open.
And are out in the open. So are some of those starting to be seen right now?
Yeah, the one that's sometimes called the J-stroke,
mm-hmm.
or sometimes called the Big Dipper.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a lightning bug that is found out in open fields, old agricultural fields, even in lawns.
I think that must be the most traditional firefly to me growing up as a kid, because, I was always seeing those. Didn't know what they were called when I was a kid, but there were always ones out in the grass over your yard, grassy lawns and things like that.
Yeah, suburban areas, they were the ones in our lawn when I was a kid. And they're called the J-stroke because they flash their lights off and on, so their lights are on for a couple seconds, but as they turn their lights on, they're descending toward the ground, and while the light is still on, they make a curve and go back up toward the sky. So it's like they're making the big letter J over and over again. And so that's how you can recognize this species as the J stroke, or called the Big Dipper, because they dip down and then go up. And so they're repeating this pattern over and over again. And the cool thing is the females, once again, are on the ground, but they will respond to the J stroke. If a lightning bug makes the J stroke, the female sees that she'll do a quick little flash on the ground. Then the male will come down a little bit closer, make another J stroke. And about 2 seconds after the J stroke ends, the female makes her little flash. Then the male comes down a little closer, repeats this, and finally will land on the ground close to the female and locate the female for mating. But the interesting part of this, at least to me, is you can imitate the female. If you have a little pen light and you go underneath one of these J-stroke lightning bugs and you wait 2 seconds after it finishes its J, you just quickly flash your light off and on, the male will come closer. And then you can call in the males by imitating the female response.
And you're doing well enough, you could have a conjunction.
more than a conjunction. Right? The male will come right up to where you're flashlight is, your pen light, and then we have extreme disappointment. So
right.
It might be a little cruel to them.
Yeah, right. You know, there are some species that are predatory as adults that will actually fool other fireflies into coming to check them out. The male is coming down and to get a potential mate, and they end up becoming a meal.
Yeah.
But because all the different fireflies, they have a different way of flashing their lights, a different sequence of number flashes in a multi-second period or something like that, and there is trickery involved there.
True.
Sometimes where you think you're going on meet a lovely female bioluminescent beetle, and you end up becoming the meal of that other bioluminescent beetle who is a trickster, a stranger in disguise,
right?
Yeah,
right. A wolf in sheep's clothing.
Yeah, so be aware.
But these Photinus carolinus, these J-stroke lightning bugs, that's the ones we used to catch. And I remember as a kid, someone had told us, if you get enough of those in a jar, you can read a newspaper by their light. Have you ever heard that?
Oh, yeah. But I'm sure that would take quite a few.
And we always would try that. And we'd get like a jar pretty full, and we could never read the newspaper.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you need to have your eyesight checked.
Maybe, yeah.
Or maybe you just didn't get enough fireflies.
Yeah.
Or maybe you should put a whole bunch in one jar and another in another jar, and then you have stereo jars left and right of the light.
Maybe we just didn't catch enough.
Maybe you just didn't catch enough.
But that
is also a lie.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, that's true. Who knows? But anyway, they're...
That was a trick just to get you to catch as many as you could.
Kept the kids occupied.
Kept the kids occupied. So right. If you catch enough of those kids, go out there and just spend time. Catch enough of those, you will be able to read the newspaper. Just, all the time away out there, just... I know where you're at, just catching fireflies, and me and Mom will just do some other stuff, be free of the kids for a few hours.
You can't tell kids to do that today, though.
No.
Because they would say, what's a newspaper?
Mm-hmm.
And so that wouldn't work today.
Maybe you could say, read a book.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't even know if they do that anymore.
Well, another one that's probably second most famous, I don't know, it might even be more famous than the Blue Ghost, nationally, I don't know, is the synchronous flashing firefly. And those are also coming out right now. And they'll be out through about the middle of June. And these insects fly through the edges of woods, sometimes into the woods. And the males have kind of a similar story. The males are flying and flashing. The females will respond from the ground. The males have a habit of flashing about 5 times consecutive, 5 short flashes. And then they pause for like 5 or 6 seconds. Then they flash 5 times again. And then they pause. But the interesting thing is if you get a group of these synchronous flashing fireflies, maybe a group of several dozen, 50, 100, they will tend to synchronize and all do their flashing at the same time and then all go dark at the same time. And what they're doing is they're coordinating kind of with their nearest neighbor. I'm not sure if this makes them more noticeable to the females or that...
I think it would be confusing to the females.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, there's so many out here, who am I going to choose?
Yeah. Or it might be that the... maybe the first one to start, the first one to stop, is the one she would choose. And so if your neighbor flashes, you have to flash quickly so to catch up to your neighbor so that the female will not choose your neighbor. Some kind of competition like that.
You don't think they just do it just to please us?
No, I don't think so. But anyway, years ago I was riding my bike down the Blue Ridge Parkway at night without a light, and which I don't recommend.
I was going to say, not a good idea.
Not a good idea. But... And as you go down the mountainside, you can see these synchronous flashing fireflies. And from the side of the road moving, it looks like a wave of light going down the mountain as they all synchronize with their nearest neighbor. And it's like pulses of light moving down the mountainside. So it's a great thing to observe from a little bit of a distance of the synchronous flashing fireflies, which now, they're in the Smokies, people have an annual... pilgrimage to see them.
Right, but you have to sign up for a lottery because it's so popular to get a space to be able to see them.
That's right, yeah. But it's just magical. Every kid should have a chance to look at fireflies, chase them, catch a few fireflies, and it's just a part of growing up, I think. It's the magic of nature. An insect that turns on the light while it's flying.
Yeah, it does make you appreciate insects. Maybe that'll lead to appreciation of other insects as well.
Yep.
Okay, well, next up on Nature News.
Okay.
Let's get into some listener reports, and since we're just talking about an insect, I have an interesting report here from one of our listeners, Steve Pettis, who sent us an article he had written, and this tells us about one of our other favorite insects that flies, has bright colors, doesn't have lights, but one of the things that we've been talking about a lot on Nature News is springtime, because we've had good numbers of them, more like a regular spring than we've had in a while. We're talking about the tiger swallowtail butterfly.
Okay, yeah, beautiful.
Yeah,
beautiful butterfly.
Yeah, beautiful yellow butterfly with a black wing stripe and stuff. But I started to say Appalachian tiger swallowtail because in our area here in the Appalachians, there is a different race, subspecies, whatever you want to call it, and it is referred to as the Appalachian tiger swallowtail. A lot of people have never heard of that, but he wrote a little article, and he was quoting some stuff here. And I'm going to read just a few little... snippets from his article here.
Okay.
And so the people are aware of this. And 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 one thing to be aware of, if you see an exceptionally large tiger swallowtail butterfly, it may be this particular race.
Okay.
So he says, it turns out that here in Henderson County's Appalachian Mountains, there is a unique tiger swallowtail butterfly species. And according to an article from the University of Texas at Austin, scientists from the University of Texas Austin and Harvard University discovered that the Appalachian tiger swallowtail, Papilio appalachiensis, evolved from mixing between the eastern tiger swallowtail, which is a species we have locally, and the Canadian tiger swallowtail. And it says that the Appalachian tiger swallowtail rarely reproduces with its parental species and is a unique mixture of the two in both of its outward traits and inward genetic makeup. They have determined that the eastern tiger swallowtails prefer warmer climates and lower elevations, and that the females come in two different forms. They're either striped, yellow and black, or almost entirely black, the latter mimicking a poisonous butterfly called the pipevine swallowtail. And the Canadian tigers are only striped yellow and black and found in cooler habitats at the higher latitudes and elevations, and that the Appalachian tiger exhibits a mix of those traits. It shares an affinity for cooler habitats with the Canadian tiger, while sharing the ability to mimic the black pipevine swallowtail with the eastern tiger. And as for identifying the species in the wild, the Appalachian tigers are twice the size of Canadian tigers. It says it's a bit more difficult to distinguish between the eastern and the Appalachian tigers, but the eastern tiger has more blue in the hind wing and a spotted yellow band on its forewing underneath underside, compared with a solid broad band on the Appalachian tiger. So, you know, it's, you know, since this is not TV, we can't show you pictures, but if you look at pictures of these things, you can see, oh, there's quite a bit of difference between the regular tiger swallowtail that we have right here and the Appalachian tiger swallowtail. And we don't see large numbers except locally in certain areas of the Appalachian tiger swallowtail. So to most people, if you just see a tiger swallowtail, it's a tiger swallowtail, you know, and you might determine whether it's a male or female based on the color and pattern, stuff like that. But just know that the Appalachians here have some very unique things that are going on, and that we have this very special race. Sometimes you see it at certain times of year here, and sometimes you don't notice it because you weren't in the right place at the right time. Personally, I don't think I've seen it this year, but I haven't really been out looking specifically at individual tiger swallowtails, but I have seen it numerous times before. And it is just so much bigger, so much prettier, with more intense coloration and broad submarginal band on the wings there, that it's, you can look at it and say, wow, that is an exceptionally nice looking tiger swallowtail. And when you see something like that, it just might be the Appalachian tiger swallowtail.
Right. Especially this time of year. You see them like early in the year. Maybe they have one brood per year. I'm not
right,
sure.
I think it is one brood per year.
And so you would see them like in May or June, and now is the time to go out looking for them. But
right,
I think size might be the number one thing.
Right, yeah, probably so. All right, so those are two insects that people love, the tiger swallowtail butterfly and
right,
the previous thing we talked about, the fireflies.
Right.
Now we're going to talk about a insect that people hate.
Oh, okay.
And we had a nice video sent of this, of hundreds of them swarming, that was sent in to by our listeners, Ben and Carol Ringer, here in Henderson County, here in West North Carolina, where Nature News calls home, here in the Southern Appalachian Mountains. And they just wanted to be sure that this was not some other kind of insect, so that it was sent this little short video, color video in of a big rotting tree section, and all these swarming insects flying around it, and some were landing, some were flying. And if you looked individually at some of the insects when they land, you could tell that they have wings.
Okay.
And they almost look like ants with wings, and their ants do fly and swarm like that when they're spreading their numbers. But these weren't ants. If you look very closely, they weren't ants. They were termites.
Oh.
And so when termites build up their population, usually in late April or mid-May, or maybe even a little bit later, depending on your elevation, they suddenly swarm, and they have all these new termites flying out to try to find a new home. And that's something you don't want to discover around your house.
Right.
Like in your house outright on the edge of your house, something like that, because that might be termites are in the timbers of your foundation or something like that. But if you see it out in the woods around a dead tree or something, that is a normal thing to see. And it's just amazing how many termites are going out and flying around. And when they land somewhere, you know, they shed their wings and they start burrowing into the dead wood and start their new colonies.
I wonder if they would be attracted to lights in there.
I would imagine they might be.
Would you like,
yes,
if you notice a swarm nearby,
yeah,
maybe don't have any lights on,
yeah,
the next night or two?
Yeah, I've actually attracted them that way with a light, because I actually have had them in places where I
oh, really?
Wish they hadn't been.
Yeah.
But you can sometimes attract them with a light to kind of concentrate in a certain area, maybe catch a few of those things.
Yeah. Yeah.
So thanks to being a Carol Ringer for that. And then also we had another photograph sent to us. It's pretty cool, from one of our good friends and listeners, Pat McKee. And she sent a picture of a little creature that was sitting, I think it was on, I couldn't...
Let me see if I can find
see,
it.
See if you find that email. Yeah. I think maybe it was on the back of a
email?
Chair or something like that, outdoors,
oh,
like a porch glider.
The arm of a chair, maybe.
Or something like that. And she was mentioning how it has this great camouflage.
Yeah, let's see, I got it.
And
yeah,
there's
there
a picture
is,
of
yeah.
it. And it's a gray tree frog.
Yeah.
And it's sitting on a little bit of a metal part of a chair or something, outdoor chair or something like that. But right below it is the fabric of the chair, and the fabric of the chair looks almost exactly the same color,
right.
Dark and light gray, dark gray pattern that the gray tree frog has. So if that gray tree frog was actually sitting on the fabric of the chair itself, you would have never noticed. But she said she almost power washed it
uh-huh.
off because it was she was out there doing some power washing.
Yeah, and it looks like lichens that could be growing on a rock.
Oh yeah.
Or a tree
so
trunk.
If you know what a gray tree frog looks like. They're actually starting to call right now. This is their time of year where the weather gets a little bit warmer, and we're starting to have some thunderstorm activity. They like to come to puddles and pools that are formed after thunderstorms on the ground or anywhere water will collect, even in buckets and horse troughs and wheelbarrows and wagons and stuff like that. You'd be surprised where they'll go lay their eggs, but obviously the most natural area would be a puddle on the ground outside. But they will have a breeding season literally all summer long. And they have this high-pitched trilling sound that is very short and harsh. And they do that at night on these rainy nights. And you'll hear a few of them calling out. But if we start having some steady rains at night, like thunderstorms, you'll hear them in big breeding courses. And they are just they're about the size of the end of your thumb. The female's a little bit bigger. But they're this mix of light gray and dark gray. But they can change your colors to look very greenish in color. They can change your colors to look very darkish, blackish in color. So they almost look like it's dirt or soil. And then if they're turning light greenish, they look like the leaves. And they are a tree frog, so they climb up high in the trees. But they come to the ground and there's puddles of water this time of year to lay their eggs and meet the other tree frogs. And males call for the females to come and show them where the puddles are forming this year. And they are probably my definitely favorite frog of all time. A frog that can climb trees, a frog that can change its color, a frog that has these interesting camouflage colors. And also they have kind of a bumpy body, so they almost look toad-like,
yeah.
You know, rather than frog-like. But they are definitely a frog and a very interesting frog. And one other thing, Dan, about them is very interesting. There are two species here in the eastern United States. There's one is called the Cope's gray tree frog, which uh-huh. we have here, sometimes called the lesser gray tree frog.
Okay.
And there's one called the common gray tree frog or the greater tree frog. And it looks identical, but it is found further north of us. There's a few populations in North Carolina, but very few. So in North Carolina, the common gray tree frog is actually very rare, but north of North Carolina, it's very, very common. But here in North Carolina, we have, from coast to mountains, we have the Cope's gray tree frog, which is a smaller species, but they look identical, but their calls are slightly different. But if you had to tell the difference, if you couldn't hear them call, scientists can, I think, take cells, samples from the eyelids or places like that, and they can tell one from the other by doing all the genetic analysis that they do. But it's interesting that they are so cryptic, but there are two species that look so much alike, but they're actually two different species.
Right. And they have kind of toe pads, kind of like suction cup type feet. They can like crawl up vertical surfaces, like even glass.
Well, they can stick to glass, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah. I remember one of my first nights after I had moved into my present house, I had a gray tree frog up adhered to one of the windows, which when I saw that for the first time, that was amazing that they can do that. So, okay, and I haven't really noticed that since then, just that
yeah.
one occurrence.
Yeah.
Even though I have gray tree frogs in the area.
Right.
Why would that be? Why would they crawl up the window all those years ago and never do it again?
Well, it could be a rainstorm that just brought them up a tree near your house and they jumped. Maybe they're trying to jump in an insect that was on the
uh-huh.
window or something like that,
Yeah.
But people do report them. And other tree frogs in other parts of the country, people report them sometimes jumping on their windows.
Yeah, I would like to see
that
again, in other words.
But they may be chasing a bug or something like that.
Okay.
That has also attracted the lights. Bugs
that's
attracted
true.
The lights.
That's true.
Yeah. So thanks for those listener reports there. And we'll give our contact information here just in a little bit again in case you didn't get that earlier. So we love to hear those reports. Then next up on Nature News, I've got a couple little nature observations.
Okay, good.
I'd like to tell from the past week, 10 days.
Okay.
And they both involve the same type of bird.
Okay.
And an interesting sound that I've heard that ties them all together.
Okay.
So I was here at the Nature News studio a week or so ago, maybe, and I was unloading something out of my truck kind of late in the afternoon. It was less than an hour before it was going to get really dark. And I heard this loud peeping sound that sounded like it was amplified. And it sounded like a young bird or something. You know, I had it tracked it in. It was actually coming from underneath my truck.
Hmm.
And it was bouncing off the fuel tank or whatever down there, like a sounding board or something. It sounded really loud. And it was a young bird that obviously had jumped out of the nest a little bit prematurely, couldn't fly yet. And that's a thing that happens quite often. And when people see those little birds, they think they're abandoned, and they try to raise it, and they end up dying, or they take it to a wildlife rehabilitator, and the wildlife rehabilitators already have 100 of them and that kind of stuff, you know. So in most cases, those little babies don't really need your help, but they look so vulnerable. You know, when there's predators around, you worry about them and that kind of stuff. But in any case, I caught this little bird, and I didn't notice any parent bird around paying any attention to it or anything, because I was working in this general vicinity watching. So I actually put this bird in a little small container where it could peep and call in case the parent birds were nearby, but it couldn't escape this box because I'd put it back on the ground one time and it actually walked across the road and was standing in the middle of the pavement in front of the Nature News student. I said, I got to go out and catch that bird and move it, you know, because it's going to a habitat where I don't think it came from. I think it came from a wooded area near my truck. So I went and caught it, and I had to kind of cage it there. So I was getting really worried about it, you know. I said, oh my gosh, you know, it's getting close to dark, and you know, I leave this little bird out here, a raccoon's gonna get it or something like that, you know, and there's no sign of a parent, and you know, I'm gonna have to take this thing inside, and I might end up having to raise this thing because no parent is showing up, you know. And then about the time I was about ready to just go inside, it's starting to get a little bit dark, I looked over in the leaves, and I saw a towhee. I suspected that this bird might be a towhee. I couldn't tell by the coloration of feathers because, you know, immature birds don't look like the adults.
Right.
But I saw a male rufous-sided towhee over in the leaves about 10, 12 feet away, and he was paying attention to that chirping. He was jumping around a little bit over there. So I suspected, okay, that must be his,
you
know, and not hers, his.
Right. All right.
Okay. Because a lot of our songbirds, the male and female will both raise and feed the babies.
Right.
You know, believe it or not. That doesn't happen with all of them, but in the case of many birds, it does. So, you know, and I was worried they're right there at dark. You know, the adult needs to go and find a place off the ground to roost for the night to be safe. But here's this little bird. So instead of keeping it, I kind of threw it up in the woods as close as I could to where the towhee was, and it kind of walked over that direction. And I could see them kind of getting closer to each other. And then I kind of walked away so I wouldn't disturb them.
Right.
And I never heard another peep, never saw any sign of anything. So evidently it reunited with the father. I don't know what he did to the baby to keep it safe for night, or if it made it through the night or whatever. But he came back for his baby
to
look for it. He might have been out foraging for food, and he was taking care of it.
Well,
at that point in time. So I hope they did well.
That's a happy nature story.
So fast forward about 10 days ago. In fact, just today as we record our program, we're recording our program a couple of days earlier than we are actually broadcasting. So just a little before you came over to our Nature Studio here today, at my house, which is not too far from the Nature Studio, I heard a similar sound, but it was a little bit different. And I looked at my platform bird feeder that I have, where I put bird seed on a platform for birds that don't like to stand on little perches at a tube feeder.
Right.
And certain birds will come to certain types of feeders, and others will come to others. So, and I looked out there, I saw a rufous-sided towhee male sitting on a platform feeder, and then I looked to what the sound was making, and I figured it was a young bird, and there was a young bird there, didn't have the adult plumage yet, but it was obviously with the male rufous-sided towhee. And it was almost as big as the adult,
right.
But obviously it was an adolescent fledgling bird that could fly at this point in time. And it was sitting on a little tree branch next to this platform feeder. And the male was feeding it sunflower seeds from the platform feeder and teaching it that this was one of the food sources around this neighborhood where you can get some food. And I've seen that happen a lot of times with other birds, but I think this is the first time I noticed a rufous-sided towhee doing it. And so that was neat watching that. And it's always a possibility. It could be the same bird. I don't know,
yes.
But it was
it could be,
yeah. But it's a But the big thing was, it was showing that a male father bird, a male bird, was taking care, showing a baby bird where to find food, taking care of it. In both situations, it was a male doing the parental stuff there, protecting the bird, trying to find a baby bird, feeding the baby bird. And obviously females do it as well, but in the world of songbirds, a lot of times the males work really hard right alongside the females to do that. So that was just kind of neat to see that interrelationship with that particular species, and both times it was with the male rufous-sided towhee rather than the female.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you know a female from a male rufous-sided towhee? Do you know, Dan?
Well, the males are much more colorful.
Yeah, they're kind of, they have a little orange, reddish, rusty on their breast, but they also have a kind of white, beigeish area underneath, and they have a lot of black on top. So they're kind of like, first I look black and white and a little bit of rusty red. The females, the blackish portions are replaced by more brown, so they're more brownish, and maybe that helps them blend in better when they're in a nest or something like that.
A lot of birds, the females are more camouflaged.
Right, yeah.
And especially if the females are providing the nesting duties.
Right, yeah. So I thought that was kind of cool. So, you know, that's one of the things that sometimes if you sit on your deck or just to pay attention, sitting in your yard in a chair or something. Actually, I was in the kitchen looking out an open door when I saw this going on. I was busy working. But to spend a little time sitting around and maybe watching these relationships at this time of year, and you'll see parent birds bringing babies to the feeder, teaching them there's a food source here or there, or sit out somewhere else. You just notice these little things that happen in the world of nature around you that you might not notice otherwise.
Right. Have you been having any black bears take out your feeders?
I've had a couple of poles bent down that I know it was black bear, but I have not seen a black bear this spring yet.
They've been really active in the kind of North Asheville Beaver Dam area, destroying people's bird feeders.
They show the parents show their babies where to feed too.
That's right. That's true. Yeah. And in fact, if you go to BearWise, the BearWise organization, they're recommending not to have bird feeders. Period.
Yeah.
Which that'd be a tough thing to do, but if you had bears doing damage around your property, I guess you would.
Yeah, I think places that sell bird feeders specifically and bird food, they would not like to hear that.
I was thinking that
yeah.
You know, if you owned a birder's shop and you're selling bird feed, this would be.
But if everybody just quit feeding the birds for next 5 years, and then suddenly start, we might have less problems. But eventually, the bears would be back. They figured out. And personally, I'm not going to stop feeding the birds.
Right. Well, talk about adults training their young. You know, the adult bears are training their young to feed.
Oh, yes,
to
learned behavior.
And so it would have to be a generational thing. You'd have to have everyone agree to stop for, like you said, 5 years or more until we get a new generation of bears that don't associate bird feeders with food for bears.
Right, right, yeah.
But that's unfortunate that bears have learned that trick.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. All right. Let's see. I had a question came in.
Oh, yeah? Another question?
Yeah. It was basically, it was about peregrine falcons, but it was something along the lines, I don't have it with me right now, of are these the highest flying birds, peregrine falcons? I mean, are they, you know, how high do birds fly? What is the highest flying bird?
Okay. And do we have an answer for that?
Yeah. I kind of do.
Now, peregrine falcons are the fastest flying birds in a dive. I think the maximum speed has ever been recorded is 242 miles per hour, as I'm was recently informed. So they routinely dive at speeds of up to and over 200 miles per hour in a dive to kill a prey bird that they feed. They feed on other birds in midair, and they hit them with their feet.
Right.
Blunt force trauma to kill that bird. But that's
and they have to go pretty high, so they
dive down that speed without hitting the ground. That's true, but they don't fly the highest. I mean, when you get too high, it's cold up there. It's well below zero. You know, when we see jets flying over, and even in the summertime, and you see them up there where they're making the contrails, it can be 10, 20, 30 degrees below zero up in those spots up there. You know, and why would a bird want to fly that high if it could fly that high or need to fly that high? I mean, I would assume most birds would fly a whole lot less than something like that.
Yeah, I would think so, too. And
for practical purposes.
One of the birds that I'm sure flies higher than a peregrine falcon would be like the turkey vulture, which will spiral upward, gain altitude in one of these updrafts. And they could go thousands of feet up.
Right.
And then they will glide slowly down. And they get a wide-ranging area where they can scan you know, the landscape looking for something for them to eat.
Right.
And so they can definitely go, I don't know.
Of course, they go too high, they can't see it.
Yeah.
And they get too high, they can't smell it. Because they are one of the few birds that have a sense of smell.
But they can move a long distance by doing it.
Yeah, and broadwing hawks often, you know, ride thermals up, but that, you know, to get high. But the thing is, if you're circling high and high and higher, you're normally riding a warm air current, a column of air, and as you get higher and higher, it eventually cools off,
right,
and you fly out of that. So how high can a thermal take you before it runs out? And I don't think it would be as high as 20 or 30,000 feet like where the jets fly.
That's true. But one bird that they have encountered up where the jets fly is something like the crane, especially cranes like the common crane that migrates over the Himalaya Mountains.
Okay, so this is not an
area.
When you get over the Himalayas, you got to get thousands of feet high because the Himalayans are thousands of feet high to begin with.
Right, and so the jets are up there like 35,000 feet, between 30 and 40,000 feet.
Yeah.
And so those birds migrating, only when they're migrating, I guess, can get up. That's the highest bird flight that I've ever heard of.
Yeah.
But around here, I would guess maybe one of our listeners would have some more information. I would think, you know, turkey vulture, maybe black vulture, getting up really high, higher than a peregrine falcon.
But I think you would not need to get too awfully high unless you had a long ways to go and you wanted to glide somewhere,
from a high elevation.
Because it gets so cold up there, there's not a lot of advantage of being too awfully high. Like I said, if you're riding warm air currents to help you move and not flapping your wings, and then when you get too high, you're running out of those warm air currents and you just have to glide, and then the temperature is so low up there, and the effort to get up that high would take away a lot of the energy that you would have lost. You know, you could lose a lot of energy in terms of caloric value to get up there to make up for the distance you're going.
But, I mean, on some of these air currents, though, they're actually gliding as they go up. But what about like a duck, a mallard duck in migration? They fly pretty high.
Yeah.
So so those are all of them, I think, would be higher than a peregrine falcon. So they're famous because they go pretty high and then dive down in hunting.
Yeah.
But I think there are other birds that would go even higher.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
So birds can fly high, but if they do it, they're probably doing it for a good reason.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's see. I got a wildflower list.
Okay, let's have a wildflower list. We've got just a few minutes left here at Nature News.
This is going to be really short.
Okay.
And, in fact, it's going to be one species.
What? Wait a minute. This is the month of May.
Is one species?
There are dozens of species.
Yeah.
Are you going to focus just one very special one?
In the interest of time, because I noticed this plant this week, and it's extremely beautiful, and you don't see it everywhere. When you see it, sometimes it's pretty common, but in a lot of areas it is absent. It's one of our trilliums, and it's called Vases trillium. And it's a beautiful, beautiful plant. It has, the three leaves typical of a trillium plant, and it's got a flower which is a bright maroon color, I guess. I don't know how you describe the color. It's a reddish, it's not bright red, reddish purple, purplish red color.
Is this one that actually smells a little bad?
I think a lot of them do smell bad.
Yeah, and sometimes they're called like stinking gem or something like that. But it's a beautiful wildflower. It's a deep royal purple.
Right, and it's very large. Maybe our largest petals of any of our trilliums, but the flower is held down below the leaves.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times you walk by it and don't notice.
But it wouldn't be considered to be a nodding trillium.
It's usually not called nodding trillium. Okay. One of its relatives is called the southern nodding trillium.
Okay.
So it's maroon flowers hanging below the leaves, but if you're looking up a slope, then you see them all kind of hanging down. It's a beautiful plant.
So they bloom so that things like the box turtles and the insects and the snakes and things crawling in the forest will look up and see the beautiful flowers, which they might not be able to take advantage of and see because they're not tall enough to be above them.
Yeah, it's interesting that they are drooping down like that. Yeah. You might wonder what the pollinator is. Mm. A lot of them do have this smell like a fetid smell, or smell of rotting flesh.
It sounds like it would be a fly pollinator.
Yeah, and so, and the color, which is kind of, it's the color of raw, almost rotting meat as well. So anyway, the Vases trillium is part of a species complex. There are about six or eight species that all relate with each other, all can interbreed, sometimes get intermediate forms, hard to tell them apart, and it's usually called the trillium erectum complex. Trillium erectum is the red wake rod. And so this would at one time have been considered a form, a variety of the wake rod, but now it's considered its own species.
I think that the whole trillium group, when I was growing up and paying attention to trillium, seemed to be so much simpler, but now it's so much more complicated that people really paid attention to all the different variations and
split them off into species.
Yeah.
And that's true. I mean, you would think a trillium being big, three petals, mm-hmm. you know, it'd be easy to classify them.
Yeah.
But you see intermediate forms that are hard to tell apart.
But you see that in a lot of things, not probably more in plants than anything else, but in animals. You see different color forms, and they're maybe the same species, and things like salamanders, particularly with the genetic research they do, they find out that these two different looking salamanders are actually the exact same species, you know, and it's just real confusing out there. And sometimes you wonder, does it really matter that much that we get down to the exact subspecies, race, whatever, unless it's something that's really rare in a habitat and needs to be protected or something like that. It almost seems like, well, you know, well, maybe we're splitting hairs too much.
That's right. Nature doesn't believe in species. They just grow things like the Vaces trillium used to be called Trillium erectum variety vacei. And one of its other relatives, the sweet white trillium, Trillium simile, used to be Trillium erectum variety vacei forma simile. They were all considered the same species. Now they're all separate species. So trilliums, that's one of the things I like about trilliums.
Yeah.
You're always finding different, almost every cove you go in, you could find trilliums that are almost unique to that cove. So anyway, that's my species list for this week.
Okay, well, I'm glad it was only one species, because if we had that kind of discussion with any others, we wouldn't have enough time for this week's Nature News. So we're about out of time now. We're going to give our contact information right quick, and then we're going to leave the air.
Okay. You can reach us. Our email address is naturenewswnc@gmail.com. WNC stands for Western North Carolina. naturenewswnc@gmail.com. Our telephone number?
Telephone number 24 hours a day, area code 828, then 891-5169. Area code 828, and then phone number 891-5169.
And you can send us a card or letter at Nature News 3150 North Mills River Road, Mills River, North Carolina, zip 28759.
And also remember, if you want to listen to Nature News on demand without getting up early on a Saturday morning, listen to us when we're broadcast on WTZQ Radio 1600 AM or 95.3 FM from 7 to 8 AM Saturday mornings, you just go to their website at WTZQ.com. That's WTZQ.com. You click on the tab there that says Programs, and you look at the list of programs come up. When you see our program, Nature News is our program's name. Click on the words Nature News. That'll redirect you to our web presence on the webpage. You'll see that the most recent 4 to 5 broadcasts are archived on the website there with a little description of what we're talking about that week. And you dig a little bit deeper, you'll find out that go scrolling down towards the bottom of the page, you can actually access some other back broadcasts of Nature News from previous years as well.
Okay, thank you for listening to our program. This is Dan Lazar.
And I'm Carlton Burke.
Go out and enjoy these beautiful days of spring, which are flowing by much too quickly. Enjoy the night sky, the sunset, the planet Jupiter approaching closer and closer to Venus. Until next week, stay tuned to the same station. We'll be back again next Saturday morning at the same time with another edition of
Nature News.